Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with Paul Waddy. Paul guests on my podcast as a guest mentor. He is one of my favorite people in the e-commerce space. He's based out of Australia and he owns an e-commerce agency. He also owns a marketing business. He also owns his own e-commerce learning platform called Learn E-commerce. This guy does it all. He does consulting, agency work, and now online training, learning, and he's just started his own podcast. And I think he has a really no-nonsense, nuts and bolts approach to making sure that your e-commerce business will be successful. We had a great conversation. I think you're going to really enjoy it. Welcome to Mentoring Moments. Mentoring Moments is a sub-series of the E-commerce Edge podcast. It is composed of clips taken from Jason's one-to-one and group mentorship sessions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is my very great pleasure to welcome Paul Waddy to the pod. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Jason. This has been a long time coming. We've had this date of destiny for a long time, so I'm very excited.
Mate, I don't want to act like too much of a fanboy, but I have honestly been a big fan of your career, a big fan of your work, a big fan of how you put yourself out into the world for a very long time. You're from the beautiful city of Sydney and the great state of New South Wales in Australia. And I built my career largely in New Zealand over the last 24 years. And you cannot be in the ANZ e-commerce ecosystem and not run across you very regularly. And that speaks, I think that speaks to the splash that you have made in the industry over the last couple of decades yourself. There's not that many of us that have enough gray hairs to say we've been doing this for as long as we have, is there?
Yeah, thank you very much, Jason. That's very humbling coming from someone like you, who I also have a lot of respect for. Yeah, man, it sounds like my frequency and reach is good. Yeah, I think it's funny you say that. I do work very hard at getting out and being busy and so on. It actually doesn't come naturally to me though. So I do have to make there's two Pauls, right? There's a Paul that's out there hustling and doing these things. And then there's the Paul at home, which is actually very different. But it's part of what we need to do to achieve certain goals. Mine is to create the best life I can for me, but my family, most importantly, which we also spoke about offline, and then their kids and then their kids. And that's what motivates me to be busy. But yeah, mate, I've been doing this since I started my first business in 2005. I was actually a trade union official and I wasn't loving that. And I started like tinkering around. And then 2007, I registered a domain and had a website built on Magento. And I guess I was in e-commerce from 2007. But tinkering since 2005. And I tell you what, speaking of grays, I definitely, it wasn't this gray until the last couple of years. It was either having kids or doing a little bit of extra work.
But hey, you still have your hair. So be very thankful because I tell you, this industry will make you lose your hair too. So be thankful.
Absolutely.
Look, and it's the other thing I think is that the breadth and depth that you have gone into in the e-commerce game to where now you're an author, you're a best-selling author of Shopify for Dummies. You've now got this brand new podcast. You said you're on now on episode 2. You've got your training courses, which you've got your digital products. You've got an agency. You also have your consultancy. I don't want to say you're spreading yourself pretty thin, but you got your fingers in lots of e-commerce pies, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think that's just, it's a blessing and a curse. It's just the way my brain's wired is that I can't sit still. And if I see an opportunity, I need to take it. Or if I see a problem that I think I can solve, then I need to solve it. And so that for me is just, I'm one of those guys who, I don't know if I'm a perfectionist or whatever. I probably am, but I know that's not a good thing. Definitely progress over perfection is definitely key for me. But I'm that sort of guy who, digital product, for example, I've got an online course for beginners. Right now, I'm about to launch one. Actually, after this call, I've got clients, prospective clients moving into a group coaching program, which is called Ecom 100. But I'm one of those guys, like I had a pretty good funnel built out. I started learning about funnels for my online course. It was a little bit different to e-commerce. I was looking at click funnels and really learning about funnels, webinars and things like that. Lead gen, which is great, different to selling a product. I was like, great, selling a service. I'm actually trying to call to action is to get a lead. And I was at 11 o'clock at night. I know I should be sleeping, but I just stumbled across something that I liked. And I just 1.5 hours later, I was like on Upwork trying to find contractors that can build these funnels for me. Sometimes I'm like, this is great because it drives me incredibly. Like I know that I'll get so much stuff done and I know that I'll start 4 or 5 businesses and invest in 2 or 3 in the last 3 years, plus had three kids in 4 years as well. That's great. Like it's definitely helped me, but there's an element of I'm an anxious person. There is an element of it drives you and you got to harness that. And then there's an element of that also, which is not so productive when you're going to get to the end of the day and you're just like completely drained. So for me, it's about finding that balance between using that spark to be a high performer and but also not burning out and making my brain explode.
Man, I can definitely feel you there. We've followed parallel paths in some respects, not entirely, because I haven't written a book yet, but certainly there's certain parallels there that leap out at me. And I'm very much the same. I'm now 49 and I turned 50 this year. And I got married very late in life. And so the reality is we're just coming up to our 4th year anniversary this year. And I think I had a chance to get some of that anxious energy out of my system, luckily, before I met my now wife. And I think I had slowly started to maybe get my priorities straighter by the time we decided to make this move to Mexico and by the time I decided to go into consulting and do my own thing. But I can certainly identify and appreciate the whole concept of how do I harness this restless energy and this excitement and this native entrepreneurship gene. How do I harness this and how do I point this in the right direction without it being self-destructive?
I think that's exactly it. And I think I was 23 when I started and my first business was okay. Like it was interesting, but again, that's where I started this it's not quite good enough kind of feeling. I had a decent job for a 23. I was a union official getting paid well and being sent to meet prime ministers and stuff and future prime ministers, heard Bob Hawke speak and sing and at a Labor conference. It was amazing, but I just wasn't fulfilled. There was something in me that just didn't want to cash that check week in, week out and do nothing. And I just had, that's where I started to get that kind of burning desire. You know, I'm meant for something else here. And started that first business with absolutely zero experience, like silly thing to do, really. Took a loan, 15 trips to Guangzhou to start a men's shoe brand just because I thought someone needed to do it because there was no good Chinese shoes. The nice Italian shoes that I liked were so expensive for a 23-year-old. And so I went to China to try and solve that problem and did a pretty good job at it. But looking back, just ludicrous, like over 10 years, 23 years old, borrowing money secured against my grandfather's house. It's stupid. And he's a saint for actually even allowing me to use his house as security because I wouldn't have. I think during that journey, I learned so much through failing. Like I was just one of those guys that had that business on paper that people were like, oh yeah, that's cool, man. You're in David Jones and you're in 200 stores and you've got 5 retail stores. You must be loaded. And I'm like, no, I'm not loaded. And quite the opposite. There was a time when I had all those stores and stuff cranking and I was like, I have $1,000 in my bank account. I'm like, look at my wife and I'm like, girlfriend at the time, I'm like, something's not right here. I'm just doing something wrong. It just doesn't feel right. And that kind of sparked me to really learn about making cash. It sounds weird, but making cash is so different from building a business. Building a business has all sorts of different objectives. And a lot of those are vanity objectives, which is of no interest to me at all. But building cash became my obsession and understanding margins and so on. Now, after I sold that business, like I was at Shopo and stuff, but I had this thing like, oh, I think I could teach this. I think I could teach people how to understand the nuances of margins and understand positive cash flow and cash conversion cycles and really understanding that it's about more than just buying some products, running some Facebook ads and, hey, can I get paid now? As Homer Simpson said after he started his internet business. And that kind of like just got me agitated. And then fast forward to today, 2024, and my primary, I advise businesses. I've invested in a couple, found a digital marketing agency in Ecom Nation with Mal Cheer and Andrew Sabatino, which is going really well. But then wanted to start teaching newbies. Because like at 23, I found e-commerce and it was like amazing because I had retail stores where I was getting shafted, Jason's like shittest spots, highest rents, just that's retail. Yeah, we'll come into our center, we'll take your money, and then we'll give you the worst spot in the world. And I found e-commerce where it was like, oh, I can actually be clever here and take some market share off you guys and actually make some money. And David Jones, who I was selling to, basically saw e-commerce as this big scam. Jerry Harvey called it a scam. So I was like, bang, I'm going to get in here. I'm going to take your customers. I'm going to start selling to my own D2C channels and not through your channels. You're not paying me anyway. And I started learning about that. So I'd started this course, Ecom Start, through my website, learnecommerce.com, to teach people how to start in e-commerce. And then that's been going really well. But then I started, there's a lot of brands, without blowing my own trumpet, there's a lot of brands that want to work with me that are bigger, who are just in the same boat that I was. Like, hey, something you said resonated. Yeah, I know, because I've been there. And it's usually, Jason, it's usually like, we're going all right, but that doesn't feel right. I'm not paying myself, or I'm like turning over $20 million, but I pay myself 80 grand. And such a common story. And as people started resonating. So now what I'm doing is launching this month is Ecom 100, which is a group coaching program with myself and 10 or 12 guest coaches to really put the support around businesses to double their profits in 12 months. Put the challenge out there. Hey, man. What are you doing this for? Double your profits in 12 months or get the hell out, because it's a waste of time. All comes back to me, to what you said to me earlier, is I do everything for my family. Having a business that turns over $20 million and doesn't pay me or my family is not doing anything for my family.
So well, I would argue it's not actually doing anything for the market either, because at the end of the day, if you're not building a sustainable business, then you're probably going to go out of business, and you probably rightly should, and you should probably rightly give that market share to a business that's doing things right and actually has their priorities round the right way. Because at the end of the day, I find that a lot of these e-commerce business owners, and I know because my first foray into e-com was my own e-commerce pure play with a business partner. And so I know I did the same thing as you. I built an e-commerce business and I know how bloody hard it is. And so I've been in the trenches where a lot of these retailers are, and it can be very fun and it can be sexy and it can be exciting. But if you're not making any money, at the end of the day, the piper has to be paid. And this is where I think a lot of business owners, because they wrap up their self-worth and their self-value in the success or failure of their business, they're oftentimes they're holding so tightly that they don't want to let go, even if all the signs are there that, hey, this is not a sustainable business. And so they're like a deer in the headlights, right? They don't know exactly. They know they need to change. They don't know how to change. And they're scared to change, which is the worst confluence of circumstances for a business owner to find themselves in.
Agree. And I'm not here pointing fingers saying, oh, you should be making money. That was me for 10 years. That was literally me for 10 years. So I only say it because, and same as you, that's the reality. We've been in that position. And you're 100% right. The founders that I work with who make the biggest changes, a lot of businesses come to me because they're in trouble, right? And they want to make more money and, or they want to scale. But generally, it's, we're doing okay, but profit's not there. Now, I think coming back to my personal scenario, it's, you've got to swallow that pride and admit, I don't really know what I'm doing here. I need help. And the founders that I work with who make the biggest changes are the ones who are vulnerable and just say, take me on the journey. I just want to learn. I've effed up. I'm being transparent. And the ones, and I do triage calls where you just suss out the clients. And the ones that are just like, no, it's all really good. And yeah, I think we're making 4 million. I'm fine. Everything's good. I just need help scaling. I'm out. You've got to really be prepared to embrace change. My job is actually quite easy, Jason. Like, I give you the parameters to succeed. I can't make you succeed, but I give you the parameters. Like, I have this 50-30-20 rule, which is like 50% gross profit, 30% operating expenses, 20% net profit. Now, that's just the parameter to get people thinking. Those ratios can change depending on the industry and the product. Some products will never get 50% gross profit margin. Nonetheless, I give you those parameters. It's up to you to then go and action them. And I've got one client, for instance, who is losing $400,000 a month. And now, 18 months later, his profit is about $100,000 to $200,000 a month. It's a good change. He's like, thanks, Paul. Thanks. I did nothing, mate. I gave you the framework and the confidence. You didn't know that before. I just gave you the framework and the confidence. What he did is took a big axe, sharpened it, and just started chopping away at his operating expenses, eliminating air freight, pushing the margins up, and it's like, mate, you just followed the plan. You did the work. So the ones that are prepared to get in and get that sharp axe out and start chopping and start executing and making changes are the ones that succeed, because $20 million companies need $20 million ideas. If you're meandering along and things aren't working for you in your business and you're not really making aggressive changes, then isn't that what they say is the definition of insanity? It's just the same thing over and over. Shake things up, do things differently, make big moves. More of the same. I'll see you in 2 years with the same problem.
Actually, you'll probably see them in 2 years and they'll be out of business.
Unfortunately, that's the reality, is that there's a lot just run out of money. And yeah. That's a killer, because some of them are great brands in theory and great people and great creatives and really great minds, but they run out of money. That's the big problem. So that's, and again, that was me. I'm saying that was 100% me. And if you find yourself like me in that cycle where you were like, oh, I'm so close, I'll just borrow a bit more money and I'll just buy that range because that range is slightly better and I'll just up my MER to 25% and then it's going to start rolling. Oh, but hang on, then my cash is going to interest repayments. You're in a cycle, you're in a death spiral. If you're in that cycle, you're not going to break out by doing the same thing. You need to break out by changing. If you're in that debt cycle where you're borrowing, keep going, survive, have a great November where everybody's rich in November. December sucks, January sucks, February sucks, March. What sort of a business? Let's go back right to the start of our conversation. Let's improve our lives. That's stressful, man. I don't want to be stressed for 9, 10, 11 months of the year, make money in cyber, and then be depressed again for the rest of the year. The business needs to be judged on its worst month, not its best month. That does my head in. Everyone's, look at my sales in November. Show me your sales in January. That's what I'm interested in.
Or September.
Or September. Yeah. And the thing is, judge your, everything should be under the stress test. If your business is, let's say, breaking even or marginally profitable in its worst month, like its slowest month, I'm happy. But if you're down and then up in November, anybody, any mug can make sales. You got to be building your business so that it survives. And we saw this in COVID. So it survives the worst months. And that's what happened in COVID. When all the sales like dropped off afterwards, everyone just went, it just flopped because everyone was great for the loaded up their fixed costs. Great when sales are high, sales drop, run out of money. It's simple, really.
And I think a lot of the COVID-born brands, because the TAM, the total addressable market for e-commerce, exploded during COVID. Yeah. And so, of course, there was thousands of new online pure plays that rushed in to fill the void. And of course, again, if you couldn't make money during COVID, you probably don't deserve to be anywhere near an e-commerce business. But then, of course, once the TAM collapsed and everybody started going back to physical retail, which is still, as of today, as of 2024, it's 70 to 80% of all retail spend is happening in physical spaces. So the reality is when the TAM collapsed, only the best of the best with the most sustainable business models actually survived. There was thousands and thousands of these mom and pop stores that set up shop on Shopify during COVID. And then everybody was making money, or at least everybody was able to make sales. They may not have made a ton of money, but they made a lot of sales. And then if they didn't actually have a business model that was sustainable, and a lot of times they were buying the same crap as everybody else, they were whacking a margin on it and they were pushing it out the door. And in fact, the vast majority of those, in hindsight, that I have seen, the ones that went belly up, most of those were dropshippers. And they were dropshippers that connected to AliExpress or they connected to other sources. And all they were doing was securing the sale and passing the order directly to China and having them ship direct door to door. And in many cases, those brands really struggled, even during COVID, because of the supply chain disruptions coming out of China. And so this is where I think it's easy to be a peacetime general, right? And that's what I say. I think it's easy when everything is up and to the right, when the economy is up and to the right, when we've got zero interest rate policy, when money is cheap and everything's growing, right? Artificially in many respects, then everybody should be able to make money, right?
Yeah.
And if your business is not doing at least as much growth as inflation, then you're not growing. And the other thing that I found, especially after COVID, was a lot of brands say, oh, we're up 10% on revenue year over year. We're up 20% year on revenue. And I say, my immediate next question is, what is the difference in unit sales? Because the reality is that inflation, when it was running at 9 to 11% for 3 years, right? If your revenue was not growing at least that much and more, then if you look back at your unit sales, probably weren't growing. So you probably actually weren't making any more money because the money you were making was now worth less. And so these concepts of inflation and unit sales growth, there's lots wrapped up in this that a lot of business owners and business leaders who haven't been through one, two, or three downturns like we have, they don't have any context for how to handle these kinds of really disruptive periods in history. And I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's how I learned is I can remember it. I had a warehouse in Chatswood and the global financial crisis hit. And I was like, okay, I've got stores that I sell to who are canceling their orders. It was all really scary. I had heaps of stock. I couldn't move the stock. Consumers were super scared of this GFC word. And I was like, okay, man, I've got to find new ways to distribute product. It's actually where I started looking at marketplaces as a channel to, because I needed more channels. I couldn't move my stock fast enough. I couldn't turn my stock and I had bills to pay. And I think, again, I want to say the wartime general, the peacetime general versus the wartime general is a great example. And that is in line with what I said, like any mug can make sales. Reality is like we can sell something cheaper than everybody else and we'll make sales. To your point about unit, how many units are you moving as well? Great point also on discounting. Oh, yeah, our revenue's up, but we sold the same units. We just discounted them more. And therefore, we sold more units, but we discounted them more and revenue was up. There's a lot of nuances that's just telling us your sales are up just doesn't mean anything to me at all. Like we've seen this time and time again. Recently, Oriton is a really good example of a business that just came in and chopped their operating expenses and I think tripled their profits. And so that's impressive to me. It's like, yeah, guys, but they'd still open stores. They opened them in interesting areas where they knew their customers, like in Mossman and stuff, like, but they were like massive improvements on profit. I think Kogan recently did the same thing. And I'm always interested in those stories. I'll give a little shout out to one of my clients, eShopping Group, who's a Western Australian e-commerce business. And it's the same thing. Like they're just a good business. COVID hit. They didn't have products that kind of went up or down with COVID. They're just doing their thing, 20% year-on-year growth. And in the last 12 months, those guys, when I sit in on the board meetings, those guys have, let's say, grown their sales like 20%. But we always come down to the profit, and their profit has tripled. And wow, they've done the same sales. I remember this like at the board meeting. They've done the same sales, marginally more, 20% more sales, and only spent 50 grand more for the year to get that 20% extra sales. That for me is just a sign of a good business that's focusing on efficiency. And that's what I'm trying to find in amongst all of this is just one, those founders that understand that there is more than one job here. That like our job isn't just to flog product, as much product as we can, but those founders who really understand that we've got two jobs, right? Really got one job. We've got to sell as much stuff as we can. Of course we do. We need to make as much money as we can. We've got to spend as little as we can in doing it. That's all we need to do. We need to put upward pressure on sales and downward pressure on costs. And that gap in the middle is what you're hopefully taking home, or at least it's your net profit. Might not be what you're taking home, but that's your job. But too many people, what they're doing is just pushing their sales up, and then I'll bump my marketing spend up with it as well, and I'll raise my staff, and you're in that death spiral. We need to just strip all that back and just be really simple. If you spend more money than you make, you will be in a deficit. And you know what I find, Jason, is where people get stuck is most of them don't have a good grip on their profit and loss statement. It's you're even running a multi-million dollar business. You need to be good in the numbers. This is not a market stall anymore. You need to be great at the numbers. You're in business. You're not in fashion. You're not in beauty. You're in business. So you need to know your numbers. But where people get stuck is they might say, look, I make $1 million a month in my sales. I spend $500,000 running the business, which is too much, 50%, get that down to 300. Nonetheless, they're like, so I'm well across that. Where they're not across is the purchasing cycle. Mm-hmm. And so the open to buy. Most businesses, I say 95% don't have an open to buy, a purchasing budget, don't know how to put one together. And so what they'll do is they'll then, and it is hard because you're importing from China and stuff. You have to pay deposits and then load up and start Chinese New Year. It's really hard. But then, so they've made $1 million. They've spent $500,000 on their operating costs, and then they'll spend $600,000 on purchase orders for the next 3 months. So you're in $100,000 deficit straight away. And yeah, my job is really easy. Come in and be like, oh, did you know that you actually spent $1.1 million that month and you made $1 million? Vast majority of people are like, no, I didn't know that. Oh, cool. So what you should do is just bring your purchasing down, bring your OPEX down, and just widen that gap. And that comes back to the 50-30-20 rule. It's just giving people confidence and the tools to succeed. These people aren't silly. They just don't teach this in school. They don't teach e-commerce in schools. We're all from union official background, different background. We're all learning as we go. So my job is just to teach these frameworks and be like, cool, let's just stay in these frameworks. You've got a great brand. You've got a great product. You've got a great mind. Just stay in these bloody frameworks.
And how often do you think that they need tools, maybe a Klar or Store Hero or Wicked Reports, or there's 1,000 tools. If you log into the Shopify App Store, there's 1,000 tools for multi-touch attribution, MMM modeling, all tools to help you understand your unit economics and your cash churn and your cash burn and to understand your COGS. There's COGSy. There's a million tools, right, at the end of the day. How often is it that you go in and say, actually, you don't need any more tools? What you need is to understand what constitutes a successful business. What are the metrics that are actually the most important metrics you need to be keeping an eye on as a business owner, leader, founder, whatever it might be? We need to get you some education first before these tools are going to do you any good. Because at the end of the day, if you don't know how the tools come to the answers that they're giving you, then it's probably going to be very difficult for you to take these insights and make them actionable in a meaningful way in your business.
That's a big problem. I was just bolting on some of those tools you mentioned are great, but if you don't have the fundamental knowledge, then there really is no point. You talk about COGSy and Stocky and these things. Yeah, they all do a really good job. But to be honest with you, if you can't build it for me in Excel, I want you to be able to build it in Excel, then COGSy just makes it easier for you to review the data. But you need to understand the underlying data. And I think this is where I wasn't good when I started my business and where I became really good. And the reason I became really good is that I remember sitting with a guy called Neil Livingston, who's the CFO of MJ Bail, and he's on the board there of MJ Bail and a bunch of other companies, and he's a great CFO. And I just used to pick his brain. Hang on, explain to me COGS again. Hang on, tell me the margin. And I would just ask the question again and again and again until the penny dropped. And then when I would go in Excel and I would try and recreate these things, if I'd get stuck, what I used to do is I would put jobs up on Upwork for people much smarter than me, and I would just ask for training sessions on them. So I would just pay an hourly fee to some sort of mathematician or some sort of Excel person. And I would say, listen, what I'm trying to do is work out the margin of this and what happens if I discount it by 20%. And I wouldn't get those people to do it for me. I would get those people to teach me. And so one of my jobs was like every week, try and learn one new concept. And I would just ruminate. And this is where the anxiety comes back a little bit in my favor. I'd ruminate until I nailed it. And then I was like, I fucking got it. I understand it. And now I can apply the knowledge. Yeah, I can find somebody to do it for me, but I can apply the knowledge. And there's a feeling. I was spent yesterday with Adam and Raquel from Who is Elijah. And Adam is like going through all of the spreadsheets and he's building these great things and he's building them himself to get that foundational knowledge up. And that was exciting for me because I could see him in there. He's like, changed the formula and he's trying to work out the open to buy. And then what happens if he puts something on sale? What happens to the margin and his MER? And I'm loving it. And I said, mate, there's going to be a point where the penny's going to drop for you and it's going to all clear up for you. You're going to see this and you're just going to be so empowered by the numbers to say, if I need 3% improvement on my bottom line, bang, I need 2% off freight and I need 1% off COGS. And that's how your mind starts to see things. You start to see opportunities everywhere when you understand the foundational knowledge. So those dashboards and stuff are great, but you got to understand the underlying principles behind them. It's like seeing a formula in a spreadsheet and my first port of call, hit enter and see where the formula leads to and try and understand it. And that's a big thing I like to do is I want to see how this person did that formula. I want to understand the logic behind it. If you don't understand the logic, I don't think you can run a $10, $20, $30, $40, $50 million business just by being good at product or good at Facebook ads or good at brand. So I think it's a serious thing to learn the fundamentals behind all of those things that you just mentioned.
And at what point do you think it makes sense to bring in a financial controller, a director of finance, a CPA? In some instances, these brands will bring in CPAs to work inside the business, a financial accountant. At what point do you think most businesses, and I know there's no hard and fast rules to this, at what point do you think in the life cycle of a business, whether it's pure play online or omnichannel, whatever it is, a business's growth, when do you think it starts to make sense to have someone in the business who their sole focus is the numbers? Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening.
Well, the quickest way to grow the profit in a in an e-commerce business is to scrutinize the numbers, because there'll be improvements everywhere. If you can't scrutinize the numbers because they're not presented in a format that's acceptable, you need someone in there ASAP. So if I go into a business and I see like that their P&L is in pretty good order and that their current system is fine, no problem. I wouldn't really disrupt anything. I'd probably work on upskilling them to be able to interpret the data, because what I find is people will be in their Facebook accounts, maybe in GA4, they'll be in all sorts of platforms, but never in their P&L. So it's just about your P&L actually is your most important dashboard in e-commerce. Gross profit margin is the most important metric in e-commerce. So I would upskill them on that. If I come in and I see this is the typical one, Jason, is gross profit up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, usually an indication that COGS is being recorded incorrectly, usually an indication that they're using an accountant who doesn't understand the nuances of e-commerce, particularly importing with 6-week lead times and so on. So what I would do in that instance is try and work with the incumbent CFO or accounting firm or whatever to try and get the books in a way that we can use them. And then if they're not there after 2 months or so, then I would suggest they probably need to either bring someone in or go out to an accountant who is familiar with the e-commerce landscape and all its funny nuances. Because if someone asked me, okay, where can I improve my business? If I can't see anything in the P&L with data, I say, well, I actually don't have the confidence to give you my advice because I can't see where you're lagging. Yeah, I could have a look in Facebook and be like, hey, your iOS should be 5. I've got other clients with 7. That's really useless, right? This is useless. Where we need to look is, you know, under the hood at every aspect of the business. And the first port of call is the zero file. And if the zero file is all over the place, I can't help you. I can't. The information is not there to determine are our margins a problem? Are our OPEX a problem? Where is the problem if we're not profitable? Like the challenge of the problem with people in e-commerce is they often just blame the agency or they blame the Facebook accounts, Meta ads. Now, that's a really important part. Of course it is. Like I own a marketing agency. It's super important. Meta is always going to play a part. But fundamentally in life, if you are dependent on one thing, like TikTok could be banned in the US. Like what, who knows? Zuckerberg might wake up one day and have a meltdown and man, I don't want to be dependent on any one channel. Business is not that easy. There's 100 different channels, 100 different things we need to look at every day as business owners, and Meta is just one of them. But too many people bouncing around agencies or saying, my pet hate is poor, my business isn't working, I need help with my ROAS. And I'm like, I'm the wrong person for you.
Yeah.
Your ROAS is the outcome of a million different
of many other things.
Yeah, that's just like one thing. I'm not going to go in and be like, oh, found it. Your copy was missing an apostrophe. No, I'll reallocate 20% into top of funnel. That's all BAU stuff, which should be done or whatever. But the ROAS is the output of all the amazing things that you do as a brand owner, the problems that you solve, the pricing that you're putting out, the story that you're telling, the customer service that you're off.
Well, and the negotiations you're making with suppliers. Like this, if you buy right, you can usually sell right. And if you're buying wrong, you're never going to be able to sell right.
That's where it all starts. And that's coming back to my 50-30-20 rule, which is if you want a 50% gross margin, you need to be hitting a 70% margin on your products, roughly.
Yeah.
And it's funny, in my course, some people in my course who've got little businesses and they're like, Paul, I've got a problem. I'm only getting a 55% margin on my products and you say I need 70. I'm like, have you been making money the last year? No. You need to change it. So sometimes I'm the bearer of bad news. Like I'm just telling you, you got to push for that 70% margin on your products so that you can hit that 50% margin on your gross margin. That's going to give you 20% for ads. That's going to give you the 10% for wages. That's going to free up all your wiggle room. But there's no point just brushing that under the carpet saying, the common one I get, Jason, is 50% gross profit margin. That doesn't always apply because at scale, my margin's fine. And you see this on LinkedIn and stuff, and you have a look around. It's usually like people selling alcohol, notoriously low margins. I've got shares in an alcohol company, and our hardest furniture is a low margin.
Yep.
But I'm like, listen, man, I'm just telling you the rules. If you go in with a 40% gross profit margin and you want to take a 20% net profit, you need to run your whole business on 20%. It is impossible.
Yes, can't do it.
Can't do it. JB Hi-Fi is the only one I know who does it, 6%. But at a normal level for like people in our space, you can't run your business on 20%. And then what they'll say is, yeah, but I want to spend 20% on marketing as well. There's your profit.
That's gone.
Job done. Finished.
Yeah. You don't have any money for anything else. That's it. Just for marketing. And I think a lot of these businesses, because I'm guessing that, and I'd love your thoughts on this. How often is it when you say, here's where the margins need to be, and then they come back and they say, that's great, I'd love to do that, but if we put our margins there and we raise our prices to be at those margin levels, we won't sell anything. And then my immediate response is one of two things, and I'm not generally coming in and giving marketing or commercial or financial advice. I'm more of a operational and technical consultant. But whenever a customer kind of asks me to give some high level advice based on my experience, oftentimes when they say that and they respond and they say, if we raise our prices to have healthier margins, we won't sell anything. And then I say, you then have much bigger problems with your business model than just your margins. So what's your thoughts on that when that's the first response that they give?
Yeah, you've got much bigger problems at play here, exactly as you just said. And I think this is why it's part of the reason I started my course for the beginners. Let's get this right from the start. And what getting it right from the start means is like my two-step rule for pricing is one, aim for that 70% margin on your products. By the time you add freight and other cost of sales, you'll get down to 50, 55. So aim for that 70. How you calculate that, take your cost price, divide it by 0.3. And so I get people to do that. And then I say, take that price and tell me, does it sit fairly in between your competitors? And if it sits at the top, I don't really like to be at the top. I don't really like to be at the bottom. I just like to be in the middle. I'm not a luxury price guy. I'm not a cheap. I don't want to compete with Aldi and Walmart and stuff. Just fair price. And then I'll use my other unique selling points. So that's the first thing. For an existing business that does that, they're in a bit of trouble. Yeah, they've got problems because they've got this whole model that's a couple of years in and they're like, I'm not making any money. And then you say, yeah, your margin's 55, man. Like you need to be at 70 in this space. Okay, I've crunched the numbers, Paul, at 70%. That puts me right at the top of my category. Okay, you either need to go back and find new suppliers. And so I'm just going to tell you the reality of the situation is this will never work for you unless you've got a product and a story that justifies you being at the top. And the problem is a lot of them don't. The unique selling points are like, oh, we're just the best quality and it's really fluffy. But if you've got a product, I used this example this morning in a live session I did with the students. I'm like, if guys said, oh, I want to do t-shirts, but they're going to be expensive. I'm like, cool, what do your t-shirts do? He goes, they just look good and they're cool. They're made in Italy. And I'm like, so is Hugo Boss made in Italy? I need more than that. I said, do they make you like for a fat guy with a beer gut? Do they slim your gut? Or do they last 100 washes guaranteed with no losing their
life? No pilling, no stretch.
Yeah. What's the secret? Do they dry quicker? Oh, no. And I'm being facetious there to try and say, come on, if you're going to be at the top of your category, you can't just say to people in your comms,
it's the best.
We're the best. Trust me.
Yeah. You know,
because that was me when I started my business. People say, what's your unique selling point? Oh, we're just better quality and they'll last longer. Like, no, that's all fluff. I hate hearing that as a unique selling point. But if you've got a unique selling point that actually justifies you being at the top of your price, your category, cool. I hope you validated that. Because the worst person to ask about that is the founder. They're the worst person to ask.
Correct.
So if they validated, no, Paul, and I do hear this as well. You probably do as well, Jason. No, we're up here, but we're a luxury brand. Think you're a luxury brand. Is that what your customer actually thinks?
Yeah.
When was the last time you asked your customer what they actually think? So you got problems if you push that margin. And I had a guy recently in my course again. He's like, Paul, my margin's too low. And I said, mate, you got to find a new supplier. But there's no supplier.
Or you have to put the screws to your current suppliers and say, I need my margins to be here to be competitive. So therefore, we're going to have to work on this. What can we do to work on this? And or find a new supplier in another country, in another locale with maybe it means in some instances, and I've seen this before, maybe it means, okay, I'm going to source the raw materials. I'm going to send it to the manufacturing factory. And so instead of them making the margin on the materials, I'm going to make the margin on the materials. And that's going to bring my cost down. And so there's lots of ways to slice and dice this. But I think some business owners, they throw the towel in too soon before they look at all the options from all the way from the beginning of the supply chain all the way through till when it's in the customer's hands, they're not looking at all the opportunities for margin optimization along that supply chain. And they're also not necessarily looking at their average margin. So they might, I'm okay with, if I look at a catalog and I say, you know, half the catalog is 100% gross. And then we have another portion of the catalog that's 50. We have another portion of the catalog that's 25%. So long as our average margins are healthy across the board, then we're probably going to be okay. And we can do some range extension and we can make sure that the new products that we bring in start out at that healthy margin level. Otherwise, we don't range extend. That's the rule. And so I'd love your thoughts on how we become myopic sometimes as business owners, and we focus on the things we are good at and confident with. And if we're not good at something, for example, if some business owners, they're really good at running ads, for example, and maybe they came from an ad background or an agency background, and they thought, geez, instead of running ads for my merchant clients, why don't I just become a merchant too? And I spend all that expertise and money on my own business. But the problem is, if they are also not a really savvy negotiator and they really don't understand logistics and supply chain and reverse logistics, and they have no concept of tech and they have no concept of operations. And so if they're really good on this one thing, they look at how to optimize that one thing to the nth degree. But as a business owner, a business leader, you have to be able to optimize everything in your business, not one thing.
Yeah, you're 100% right. People want to focus on their strengths, but you've got to strengthen your weaknesses. That's the whole thing. You've got to plug the
or hire for your weaknesses at the very least.
100%. If that's not your strength, put someone in like that. And I guess that's why we're in business as well, is like plug those gaps with other skill sets. I use that example where we're so aligned on what we're saying here, Jason. I use that example as like me going to the gym and every day I just do my biceps. What am I left with at the end of the day? Great biceps. Then I pop my shorts off. My legs are like twigs. We want to be well-rounded. If you want to go to the Olympic Games, you've got to eat well, you've got to diet, you've got to get up early, you've got to go to sleep early. These are well-rounded businesses. And I think this is 100%. You often find people who are really great creatives and they make beautiful products at scale. And then they don't seem to know what I'm doing. I'm not making any money. Or you get the people who are great at Facebook ads, but garbage in, garbage out. The product's no good, or the unit economics aren't there, or they're spending 30% on ads. And really, they should be spending 15%, but they haven't been able to work out that every dollar they're spending on Facebook is not actually making them any profit. And it's piecing all of that together. And our job, both of us, is like to do two things, like you're doing it on the podcast, is to upskill people's knowledge as well, to challenge them to think in a different way. That's the first step, challenge people to be open to learning new things. And then when they're not there themselves, is to step in and upskill them. Nobody needs somebody like to come in and just solve all their problems. Just come in, help me fix this problem. Let's do it together. And I think it's really important for founders to, my whole program, the new program that I'm launching this month, is designed to help business owners double their profits in 12 months. I say help because we can't guarantee that, but definitely there is enough low-hanging fruit to have a fairly good crack at that in most businesses that I see. But the idea is we do this. We work in 6-week sprints and we diagnose your next right thing. And the next right thing is the biggest hole in your leaky boat. In other words, let's say we come in and we're like, hey, we've just benchmarked this business and your freight is 13% of revenue. We know we can get that down to 9. Bang. Next 6 weeks, we don't need to do all of the things. We need to fix that one. And my whole challenge is, I say to anyone, well, I will be saying to anyone in the program, is in 60 days, my challenge is to find you enough profit to cover the course of my consultancy for the year. That's my goal. And you can exit the program in 60 days. Because that's how we look at everything. We look at, great, I love what you're doing there, but this is what's important right now. And as founders, we go off in, and my head does this, we go off in every different direction and we get infatuated with the next shiny object. We don't need to do everything. We need to do the next right thing. And the next right thing, Jason, is probably not the thing you want to do, but that's probably why it's become a problem. So we zero in on that and we fix the things that are most likely to move the needle every 6 weeks. And every 6 weeks we reassess and we just say, let's fix these two or three things in the next 6 weeks.
And even if you only improve the business by 1% of net margin every 6 weeks, by the end of the year, we're talking compounding interest here.
Yeah.
So the reality is by the end of the year, you have a, it's not every 6 weeks, you got to improve the business by 10%.
Correct.
Even if you only improve it by 1% every 6 weeks, the cumulative impact of that at the end of the year could take a business from being extremely unprofitable and completely unsustainable to, wow, we're actually making money, and it's actually easier. We're not only making money, but the money we're making is easier to make at the same time. So this can be massive, right? And how often do you find that? Because one of the things that I often find that is way, way off base is CLVs, right? Mm-hmm. Customer lifetime value. First of all, most brands have no idea how to calculate it. Second of all, if they know how to calculate it, they're doing it on gross revenue. They're not doing it on net. They're not also taking into account any form of cost to service at the individual customer level. Because if I have the same, for all intents and purposes, let's say I have two customers that spend roughly the same amount with me, but one of them, they, for every single order they make with me, they have two live chats, they have three phone calls, and they have four emails that come into the help desk on average. Mm-hmm. And then the other one has none of those, or maybe has one live chat and that's it. And then they make their purchase on average per sale. And then I also have this one over here has a return rate, right, of 20%. This one has a return rate over here of sub 5%. I know which customer I'd rather retain in my business, and I know which one has a better net CLV for me versus the gross CLV, which is usually based on purely how much revenue or how many sales they make with us in a given year. And then they also don't know how to calculate CLV based on that customer's average purchase frequency either. And so I think that a lot of brands, they rely on CLV coming out of something like Klaviyo or their CDP or some sort of analytics platform that's telling them what their CLV is. But we now need to, when we start our segmentation process, we need to take CLV into account down both by customer level and channel level. If you are not doing that, you don't know where to start to begin to improve your CLV, do you? And so I just think that there, just like you were saying, when we're looking at margins, there are some very big gaping overlooked holes. But I think one of the very biggest holes in e-commerce today is businesses truly understanding what their CLV even is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great call out. I learned that the hard way when I thought David Jones was my biggest account, my biggest moneymaker when I was a wholesaler. And then I worked it all out with the marketing rebates and the time spent and all those sorts of things. And I was like, they're actually one of my smallest. In fact, they're at times costing me money. And it's, yeah, I get it. I get it. It's hard with having sometimes 30,000 customers or whatever, but there's plenty of platforms that will segment your highest CLV customers for you. And then it's about how do you treat those guys? G'd Up Co. does this really well, segments their VIP customers, and before every drop rings them. They need to see it. They don't need to click on a Facebook ad and pay that dollar. They get a phone call. They know they're going to get that phone call. And you know what? Their AOV is significantly higher. So we talk about how to improve lifetime value. And you're right. Nobody is really looking at it, let alone trying to improve it. Well, you increase your purchase frequency and your AOV. And so one of the ways that G'd Up has done this is just, hey, I'm just going to give you a call. You know what? I'm going to take half an hour on the call. How's the family and so on? Some of these people are spending $20,000, $30,000 over their lifetime because they take that, they know they're going to get that call. They feel like it's a concierge service. They almost feel obligated to, they're not going to end the call and be like, sorry, I'm not ordering anything. So they almost feel obligated to.
Reciprocity. You know, it's a big deal.
It is so high, and they're getting, I'm talking like more than $100,000 in a bunch of phone calls out of over a couple of days just by calling these VIPs. They have the highest lifetime value, followed by email subscribers, followed by SMS subscribers, followed by anyone who comes through Facebook is right down the end. Now, Facebook, of course, it plays a part, but
at least in acquisition anyway.
In acquisition, for sure. But this also comes back to the point of brands generally who aren't performing too well profit-wise, their customer acquisition cost is usually too high. And one, they're not using it. They might have access to it in a platform and agencies giving them their CAC, but they actually don't know how to interpret that. And you actually say, if you have a lifetime value that's four or five times your AOV, hey, go hard on your CAC. You know what? Go fantastic. You can spend 100% on your CAC. You're almost a SaaS business at that point. But yeah. If you're in furniture, which has virtually no lifetime value because you just buy it once and then you don't need it, your CAC has, if your margin's 70%, your CAC's got to be under 20%. Like, you've got to be watching that and bringing it right down. And so coming back to your point about LTV is the more you get your LTV up, the more aggressive you can go on your CAC, the faster you grow. And LTV is funny. It's just really, it's two things, like focus on your AOV and focus on your purchase frequency. Zero in on those two things. Those getting that LTV up, and I think there's not many brands that have phenomenal LTV. I always look for 3x AOV is a good AOV, is a good LTV, or LTV to AOV ratio, or LTV to CAC ratio is another one. But those two numbers, the higher the LTV, the more you can spend on the CAC to LTV ratio. But nobody's looking at it really. Like, everyone's just going as hard as they possibly can. And not everyone, but a lot of brands are struggling, just going hard as they possibly can on acquisition and being like, yeah, we hope they come back. But what are we actually doing to upsell them? What are we actually doing to increase the purchase frequency? Nothing really.
If you have a CAC LTV ratio below one, then what that means is you're actually you're paying customers to become customers of yours.
I've seen that heaps of times.
And it's scary. It's like, how, just logically speaking, you would think to yourself, wouldn't I know as a business owner that if my CAC to LTV ratio is bad, then wouldn't I be thinking to myself, I don't want to pay customers to be customers of mine over the long term. Like, in the long term, if ultimately they end up spending more with me than it cost me to acquire them, then fantastic. Then we're ahead of the game. But even in that scenario, that is gross revenue. That is not pure profit. So we also need to dig down one layer further, and we need to say, okay, is there because their LTV to us is their sales, right? Here's the total dollar they spent, $5,000 with us in the last 3 years, whatever it is. Not 100% of that $5,000 is profit. So we have to look at our net profit margin as part of our LTV and our CAC to LTV calculations, because otherwise we're measuring the wrong thing.
This is why I don't believe that this cookie cutter approach to this is how much you should spend on marketing can ever possibly work. Even if someone says, here's my margin, Jason, there's just more to it than that. It's, hey, your margin's 80%. Wow, you should be spending 35% on Facebook ads. Hang on, but aren't you going to ask about my retention? Aren't you going to ask about my net sale? Aren't you going to ask about my net profit? Aren't you actually going to ask me what my goals are? Because some people say, I want to have a 30% net profit company and just be highly profitable. Others say, no, I'm cool just breaking even and I just want to go for growth and then one day exit. And I just wrote, this is my second podcast that I released this week. It's about, firstly, I asked you at the start of the call, what are you up to? You're going to Mexico. You make the decision that suits you and your family, and then you put the building blocks underneath. You make it happen. You know what? I'll be better off in Mexico. Let's make that happen, because that's going to set me free. That's going to make me happy. Same in business. So how could I possibly say, hey, Jason, you should be spending 30%. First thing I ask anybody is, tell me about your goals. What do you want to do? Where do you want to be in 3 years? Do you want to buy a house, or do you just want to break even? You got another job, or you're going to flip this? And then we can put the building blocks in place underneath that. I can't just come in and be like, oh, mate, your margin's 80%. I haven't looked at your CAC, haven't looked at your repeat purchase rate, haven't looked at your LTV. You spend 30%. Everyone else is. There's so much more to it than that. And I like high net profit businesses that generate a lot of cash, use that cash to do other things with. That's my go. Most people don't ask that question. They're just like, hey, you should be spending more on Facebook, but you don't know my goal in life. You don't know, like, that I've got kids that I want to put through nice school and I only want to work 3 days a week. You got to understand the goal. We pick our goal in life and then we put the building blocks underneath to make it happen. Your business is likely to be your most valuable asset, even maybe more than your house. But we think about where we want to move and then we make that decision to move to suit our lives. But we've got this asset that somehow we don't operate in a way that's linked back to our grand plan. So the strategy comes from your goal first. There's a strategy to meet every goal. You don't want to make a profit, but you want to scale rapidly and burn a bit of cash because you're wealthy. That's fine. There's a strategy for that. You want to have a $2 million a year business that pockets you 400 grand a year. There's a strategy for that. So let's understand your goal before presuming to know how to give you a strategy.
Love it. Love it. Mate, an hour has absolutely blown by. Mate, you're on fire and I absolutely love it. I love your passion. Look, it's palpable what you do and why you do it and your motivations and how you position yourself out there in the world. It's inspirational, man. It's inspirational and it's aspirational. And I think that if you're going to be in the business of teaching people, of educating, then a big portion of education is inspiration. Like people have to be inspired to want to learn these things, right? Otherwise, if it's just they feel like they're going through the motions, then they're never going to put the passion behind it required to stick with it. That's the thing, is if you don't love what you're doing, or at least if you don't at least enjoy what you're doing, then you're probably not, because this e-com game, it is bloody difficult. There's nothing easy about this. And the reality is, unless you really are getting some form of joy and fulfillment out of doing this, you're not going to have the grit to stick with this long enough to see the results of your labor. And that's the thing that I try to encourage people to think about.
I love that. And that's to say, I try and bring a high energy to things and I try and make bold statements because it'll stop people and get them thinking. And I deliberately say facetious things sometimes because I want you to stop and read what I'm saying and not brush past it. So sometimes when you're thinking down here, I want you to think up here. And when people are telling you to zig, I want you to zag. I want you to work your own way out because it doesn't even matter what I tell you. It's about finding there's no cookie cutter approach. Every business is different. And we've got to understand the nuances of our business and make it work to suit us. And I want people to work hard at that, as you say, and see it through. And there's so many great stories. Vic Muscle Republic slept on the floor of his warehouse, $25 million a year now. There's so many stories like that. And that's what gets me excited. It's not about me getting rich or anything. I know if I do good work, wealth will follow. That's the thing, right? But for me, every client that I got one after this, a new one, I'm going to sit down and be like, tell me what's your goal? I write every one of those goals down and I celebrate them with you. I want to buy a house on the beach in 5 years. I'm there with you. I've got all of my clients' goals written down and that's what drives me. And it's not altruistic. It's just, I generally just love that. I just think that's great. And that means that I've done a good job and I'm in the results and reputation business. So I need to keep making sure that my clients are hitting their goals and I've got to bring the energy and the effort every single day to what I do and hustle just as hard as I'm telling other people to hustle.
Yeah. Do as I do, not just I say, right? You got to lead by example. And I think it's the same as, you know, being a parent. We don't have kids, but I was a kid. And so the reality is this whole do as I say, not as I do thing does not work. You have to model it. You have to model it in a way that makes sense and can connect the dots on behalf of other people.
That's such a good call out. If I'm feeling down, feeling tired, feeling whatever, if I open the door into my client, bang, I'm up here because you've got to set the energy. You've got to set the standard. You've got to work hard. You've got to show them that it's consistency. I've got this saying, master the monotony. There's no silver bullets taking you to the top. You start at the ground floor and you work your way up. And we've got to master that monotony and we've got to grind. And as business owners, we've also got to be the hardest working people in the rooms. That's the reality. It's not glamorous, but one day it can give you a bloody good life.
No, and I tell you, even something as simple as trying to put out 3 podcast episodes a week, and I do all the editing and post-production and distribution myself. So I'm putting in the effort because I believe that a rising tide floats all boats. And if I can help expand the pie, then like you, I know that if I work hard, I'll always get my portion. I'll always be okay. The money will look after itself. If I do a good job with good intent and I'm trying to help out and grow the industry, then if I grow the pie, then by definition, it means I can have a bigger slice of that pie. So it works for everybody. It becomes a virtuous cycle. And that's what I'm trying to contribute to in this industry.
I love that, man. That's why I wrote the book and I'm chairman of the National Online Retail Association board and stuff. That doesn't pay me, but I do that because I know it help boost the industry up. Somehow that'll get me, that's my top of funnel. Somehow that'll pay me back in the long run.
Totally. Listen, we're now coming to the end of our time together and I have about 5 other topics I'd love to get into you. We'll have to schedule more of these because I've thoroughly enjoyed our time together. I really have. I'm not just saying that. I genuinely have enjoyed this. Time has absolutely blasted by. Now we're at the point where I get to flip the script. I get to turn the microphone over to you. I get to let you ask me one question. Any question you like, can be personal or professional. So Mr. Paul Waddy, what is your question for me today?
Hey, this is interesting for me. So you've been a man that's moved around in your life and you're now in Mexico, which I think is great because I've got ideas to do things and hold back. And sometimes you've got to take the leap. And what's your grand plan? Where do you want to be in 5? That's exactly what I say to myself. Where do you want to be in 5? You're good at content. You're good at podcasting. You're 3 a week, man, is you're doing well. See, this is the thing. I now hear you're doing it. I'm like, oh, Jason's doing three a week. So where do you want to be in 5 years professionally, Perla? How would you like to be making your money in 5 years? You're great at e-commerce. Like, where's your happy place?
Yeah, look, there's a few different big, hairy, audacious goals that I have. Within the next 5 years, I'd like to be in a place where about 80 to 90% of my income is coming from the content that I put out. Whether that be a digital product, which I'm working on a few different digital product ideas at the moment, whether that be advertising on the pod or advertising on something else, whether that be public speaking, because I do a lot of public speaking, whether that means I can start making a decent income from public speaking opportunities. I've got a lot to say, and I'm not just saying it to hear my own voice. I'm really trying to take on board what Gary Vee taught me 8-9 years ago when I really started to double down. And, you know, everybody's got their own opinion on Gary Vee, and look, he ain't perfect. But one thing he did do for me is he kicked my ass enough times verbally to get me to get off the fence and actually start creating. Instead of just consuming, to start creating and putting things out in the world that had some form of creative element to them. I can't draw. I'm not an artist. I don't sculpt. My art is words, both spoken and written, in language, and being able to inspire people and being able to hopefully break down complex topics in digestible pieces that people can onboard into their life and hopefully benefit them in ways outside of business as well. And so for me, being able to practice my art and get paid for it is super exciting. And I love what I'm doing right now. I can hardly imagine doing anything else. If my life got any better, it would probably kill me. And so I'm just beyond grateful that this industry has given me the lifestyle that I have. I never take that for granted. But I think if I could get to that place where 80-90% of my income was from a content side of what I do today, I would always want to do consulting at least to a small degree, because I need to keep my sword sharp. I need to keep my finger on the pulse of what's happening in the industry. Because what I find is that when people go down this path of 100% content and they get too far removed from the industry that they're an expert in, all of a sudden their content over time becomes less and less relevant because they're farther away from the coalface. And so what they knew a year, 2 years, 3 years ago is no longer as relevant because that's not what's happening in the market anymore. And so I always want to stay current and I always want to stay relevant. So I always want to be working with clients. The other thing that I would like to have happen over the next few years is I am so enjoying, for the first time in my career, I right now have fewer merchant clients than merchant clients. And what I mean by that is I've added additional consulting strings to my bow. So instead of just consulting to merchants, I'm consulting to agencies. I'm consulting to product companies, so ISVs, and I'm also consulting to investors. And that is something that is only fairly recent. Like, it's only in the last couple of years that I've started to develop consulting frameworks for those different types of clients. And man, that has reinvigorated my love for this industry, because it's so different to consulting to merchant clients. And I'm loving it. It's stretching me. It's challenging me. It's forcing me to learn new things. It's forcing me to develop new frameworks that are applicable to my clients. And man, it gives me an additional reason to get up every day. And I love it. I think from a pure investment perspective, outside of me and my business and my family, I'm mostly just an ETF guy. I'm an index guy. I do some, you know, specific investing, but I am all about cash flow. So I am a super high dividend. Everything I invest in is all for the dividend. I'm a hardcore dividend investor, and mostly via ETF. So it ain't that sexy. I got my little bit of precious metals for a meltdown scenario. I've got the cash buffer for the world, for the zombie apocalypse. I've got different things happening, but we would also like to, buy a house here in Puebla sometime this year. Not because I necessarily think that property is a fantastic investment. My wife is Asian, and the reality is that in the Asian culture, owning property is a big deal. And for my wife to have a place she can call home, that's a big deal for her. And if I can make that happen, it's also beneficial that property here is 75% less expensive than the equivalent in Auckland. So it's a little bit more accessible. So lots of good stuff coming down the pipe, but I would say, like, big picture stuff, I want to really double down on the content thing because I love it. And I think, at least from the feedback I get, that it's really helping people. And that there's some sort of ego thing that goes along with that probably somewhere. But man, does it make me feel good when people say, man, I got so much out of that podcast. we were looking at that tech, or we were looking at doing this, and you just gave me the nudge that to go forward with that. And man, that just, even if I only get one of those messages a month, which is, you know, sometimes I'll get one a week, but that will give me enough encouragement to keep me going for another 6 months. It's just, there's something about that.
I couldn't agree more. Whenever I get a little reply to my newsletters, hey, you were talking to me. I'm like, yes, I love it. I got you. I found the needle. I'm going to hold you accountable to your goals, Jason. No, I think you're a natural. I've done heaps of these interviews and so on, and you're a natural because you're a great deliverer of content, but you also know your stuff. So I would back you to achieve those goals, mate, for sure.
I love it. Thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate that coming from you. That is a massive compliment, and I do not take it lightly. I've really enjoyed this. Let's make sure and do it again soon, my friend. Thank you so much. If you'd like to get mentored by Jason for free, head over to greenwoodconsulting.net, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click Get Mentored by Jason.